Welcome today to our interview series with Outstanding Professional. I'm Stephen Ibaraki, and I'm conducting an exclusive interview with Andrew Guitarte, business architect, Wells Fargo, founding chairman, Business Architecture Society. Andrew, you've got a great background, and I really appreciate you coming in today to share your deep experiences with the audience.
Well, thank you, Steve, for the invitation.
Andrew, again, I'm looking at many roles that you've played and your long history of success. So can you share these past roles and societal contributions and how you've succeeded in each of these roles?
Sure. I actually started out as, you might say, a geek. My background is mathematics. That was my bachelor's. I went into the master's program for computer science, which I majored in artificial intelligence. But then a shift happened when I was working for IBM way back during the turn of the century. And I saw that people were struggling with trying to make sense out of their IT investments. And most of the people who were asking the tough questions were CFOs, CEOs. And I said, maybe there's a way I can help bridge that gap between IT and business. And that's when I said, okay, I might as well follow the path and follow the thinking of the great business folks. And that's when I decided to go into the end user side of it. So I worked for the financial industry now for a little bit over 10 years. And I'm currently teaching as an adjunct professor for enterprise architecture at the Agino School of Business in Golden Gate University. At the same time, I am finishing my dissertation as part of my doctoral journey for a DBA degree at the same university at Golden Gate.
Wow, a remarkable journey indeed. And again, many insights that you could share because you've done it all. Now, Andrew, what are three key shareable lessons of each of your roles?
I would say that being a business leader demands not just business acumen, for example, knowing how to read financial statements, how to direct a team of, let's say, 200 operational folks, knowing how to comply with regulations. You also have to have a deep sense of an appreciation of the technology that drives the business. And that's almost always forgotten because business folks tend to see technology as a separate component of an organization. And that's one of the things while I'm teaching enterprise architecture, business architecture, as well as while I am trying to, for example, dig deeper into a business problem. People tend to delegate the task of finding technology-enabled solutions to the technology folks. So I think it's time to, for example, turn the table towards business and say, you know, you have to be familiar with technology speak as well and not just delegate the task to the technical folks. The flip side of that, of course, is very well known that we in technology, and I consider myself part of that as well, tend to delegate part of running a business to the business folks, which I think that's where business architecture, the profession itself and discipline comes in. We as architects of the enterprise come to realize that if we have to have relevance in this age of cloud computing and X as a platform, for example, we need to speak the language of business. And that's when we need to be able to trace, for example, our request for procurement for hardware and software all the way back to the balanced scorecard of the organization. So there's just a couple of insights I can share with you.
You know, do you really believe, though, that business people, other than to this sort of natural evolution of the consumerization of IT, will actually learn the technology speak?
Well, let me throw a question at you, Steve. How many seniors have you seen, you know, when you ride the train, for example, pull out an iPad or any kind of tablet out of their handbags, for example? You know, I've seen not one or two, but maybe half of the train, you know, with tablets in their hands. And most of these are middle age and seniors. Now, that was unthinkable, I would say, maybe a couple of years ago. So I really think that business folks cannot, you know, go against the current trend that more and more outliers, in other words, we used to call them late adopters of technology, we can't disregard the fact that they are crossing that chasm and going to the mainstream of technology. And therefore, CFOs, board members need to be aware that technology is not something you can delegate to the folks in, you know, in a data center, but actually be part of the table when you sit down and discuss strategies, for example.
Andrew, can you profile FEPL, the Federation of Enterprise Architecture Professional Organizations, as you are one of the delegates to that organization, and then its value to its members and to the external community?
Wonderful. Yes, I've had a very positive experience with FEPL, mainly because I represent a component of enterprise architecture, which is business architecture. The Federation, in its vision and mission, seeks to unite the different components of enterprise architecture into a holistic vision of what it is currently and what should be the target state for enterprise architecture. And, you know, when you talk about target, you're looking about medium-term to long-term view. And definitely, there is a current trend nowadays that even enterprise architecture is starting to evolve into something like, and people may disagree with me here, something like what the vision is for business architecture, which I and a few of my colleagues are advocating and evangelizing about. I've seen, and I'm continuing to see, my colleagues at FEPL as partners in this journey of trying to, develop this vision of enterprise architecture as being more aligned with business. As again, we have trends and we have change happening daily in front of us, and we need to adapt to that change.
Andrew, can you share the history behind the Business Architecture Society?
It was really the brainchild of a few people who felt the need that there has to be a way of rallying, I would say, the forces towards a vision wherein business architecture will eventually become a household term, such as project management and business analysis. And this group of people, including myself, based in San Francisco, felt that the best way to do that is not to rely on outside or external agents of change like the third-party analysts, the Forresters, the Gartners to define what it is, or even academia, or even consultants, but actual practitioners. And that's the reason why we formed the Business Architecture Society. And our mantra is that this is business architects for business architects. And what makes us distinct from, I guess, other associations with the same kind of thrust is that we are chapter-based. And we feel very strongly that for us to grow at this grassroots level, we need to create local chapters across the North America and across the world, where people and business fellow business architects can actually meet, shake hands, and share war stories with each other, success stories, knowledge, best practices, and so on.
What are the goals of the Society for 2012 and beyond?
One of the main work stream that we are actively involved in is the creation of the Business Architecture Body of Knowledge Handbook. It is on its, I believe, third version. And as a representative of the Business Architecture Society to the advisory board of the Business Architecture Guild, which is the one mandated to create this handbook, we provide the check and balance. We keep them honest. We put in our thoughts into how it's being written, how it's being vetted against the practitioner society. And we continue to get involved with that as the newer versions come out. Secondly, we are seeking greater participation in this organization called FEPL. And definitely I, as the delegate, as well as my alternate delegates, are continually contributing to the operations and the future plans of FEPL. So those are just a couple of plans we have for 2012, aside from building our chapters.
What is the value of business architecture?
Well, you know, there is a paradigm shift happening as we speak. And if you look back in a book written decades ago by Thomas Kuhn on the structure of scientific revolutions, he stated that for a paradigm shift to happen and for revolution, scientific revolution specifically, to happen, people have to do away with the old and embrace the new. What is happening is that business architecture is slowly but surely going into the mainstream of IT, is a term being thrown around in boardrooms, is a term that's being discussed in major conferences like the Building Business Capability Conference that's sponsored by the International Institute for Business Analysis. What is happening is that there is a shift that is occurring among us. And what is that shift? That IT, for it to be relevant in today's age, has to be strongly coordinated, tied, entwined with the business goals of an organization. And people are slowly saying that, yes, I think we're finally hitting the nail on its head. Enterprise architecture should be and must be business architecture oriented.
Andrew, what are the key diagrams and models that you recommend for business architecture and why?
One of the values that I provide whenever I'm asked that question is that I've worked as a practitioner of business architecture, not simply as a consultant or an analyst writing about business architecture. And one of the key deliverables that I've seen that's widely implemented here in Wells Fargo, for example, is a business capability model or a business capability map. Even before the object management group or the Foresters or the Gartners of this world have come up with that term, we've actually been using that here in the organization for several years now. And one of the key benefits of that is we have basically in front of us a one-pager document that illustrates our operating model, whether it's for a division or for the whole enterprise. And one of the nice things that you can do with a business capability model is that you can map it against other models that are created and owned by different parts of the organization, such as, for example, a strategy map or a business value model that's created out of the strategic planning unit, and other types of models like the organizational model that's coming out of the HR department. And therefore, this and there are many other deliverables or artifacts I can talk about in terms of business architecture deliverables if time permits.
Andrew, why is there a growing need to clarify enterprise architecture, and how would you define enterprise architecture?
I would start by probably quoting Harvard Business School in their version of enterprise architecture's definition. For them, and I'm quoting from a book that was written, I guess, a few years ago on enterprise architecture as strategy. The authors say that really it's all about process improvement and process standardization. That's what enterprise architecture is about. In a sense, they are correct because they're taking the point of view of a business person. And a business person, when they look at a business problem, almost always they start with process. And in other words, when they troubleshoot something, whether there's a bottleneck or there's a defect or a downtime or something broken, they're not meeting their revenue targets, for example, or sales targets, they look at the process and say, okay, what's wrong with the way we're doing things today? And in a sense, enterprise architecture should and must take on that approach, that really it's all about business process improvement and standardization. And once you've identified, for example, areas, the bottleneck areas or areas where you can improve and add more value, then you govern that process using tools and the organization structure that enable that process. However, as I mentioned earlier, there's a shift that's happening within the enterprise architecture world, and that we've always had that stigma that enterprise architecture is IT and not business. And that's where the concept of transforming our vision or our thrust to becoming more business-oriented architecture. And in short, we're calling it business architecture. And the idea there is that more and more, as the stakeholders from business become more important in our equation because, again, of pressures from, you know, being in a recessionary economy today, stakeholders, share owners demand more from everyone, not just from IT, but also from operations and so on. So therefore, whatever their demands are, I think it's worthwhile listening to them. And the more we are aligned with them in terms of business language, the way we present our value propositions as enterprise architects, the better it is for the profession.
Andrew, how would you then clearly differentiate a business analyst from a business architect from an enterprise architect?
I would say the main distinguishing factors is in the area of influence and scope. Let me start with influence. A business analyst, and I've practiced business analysis myself for many years, and I'm a certified CBAP professional. Business analyst, normally the scope is and influence is very project or siloed focus. And my area of, I would say, responsibility dwells within the domain of the project or even a program. Whereas the scope and influence of a business architect can start with that, but generally it extends beyond that. The business architect pretty much connects the dots across projects or across programs or even across portfolios all the way to the enterprise. And when I say enterprise, the whole organization, not just a division within an enterprise. Let me give you an example. Here in the bank, we are accustomed to viewing the organization as a series of channels or delivery channels like internet and mobile. That's one, you know, organization. Then there's the ATM. That's one organization. Then there's the phone. That's one organization. And then finally the store. So you have four major channels. If I was a business analyst assigned to, let's say, help define requirements, I'd probably be assigned as a business analyst for one channel, like online and mobile. But as a business architect, normally the reason why they want me in a meeting room is that they need someone to look across channels. And therefore, any kind of multi-channel initiative that cuts across those four major channels, a business architect can add value and say, okay, this is how I connect the dots among the four of us. You know, this is how one business requirement from one channel can be reflected across the four channels.
Now, how does that separate the business architect from the enterprise architect?
The enterprise architect, unfortunately, and when I say unfortunately, it's because, again, of that stigma that enterprise architect is IT. And therefore, they get invited only later during the process of vetting ideas. You know, when there's already an assigned project manager, and they need a system architect to be on board, that's when they need an enterprise architect to help them specify whether they're compliant with the standards of the organization in terms of procurement of hardware and software, whether they are compliant with web accessibility rules, and so on and so forth, which, you know, unfortunately, that's not just the reason why there are enterprise architects. Therefore, some of, and I've seen this in my organization, some of the enterprise architects are slowly rebranding themselves as business architects. And I co-chair an organization here in Wells Fargo called the Wells Fargo Business Architecture Center of Excellence. I formed that and I co-chair that with a couple of enterprise architects who have now jumped into the bandwagon of business architecture. And they're enjoying the benefit of having conversations with lines of business executives, which they never had before. Because now that, senior managers and lines of business executives are looking at business architecture as something different from enterprise architecture, but actually is the same person in different clothing, which is funny because it's really a rebranding exercise mainly. And once that rebranding is done, people benefit from it.
So would you say then that business architecture is a subset of enterprise architecture?
That's one point of view, and I don't disagree with that. And because that's a traditional, I would say, point of view based on whatever is already out there, the TOGAF, the Zachman framework, and so on. However, we should not necessarily put ourselves in that box because, again, as we speak, the paradigm is shifting, and there are members of my organization, for example, who are saying, no, we are a totally brand new discipline, separate from enterprise architecture. And then the other extreme, they're saying, well, there's really nothing new because we're just going to rename enterprise architecture as business architecture, right? Now, that's why there's a main benefit of having this this architecture society, because we have a free flow of ideas. And you know, in a revolution, unfortunately, again, only the victors get to write the history books. And I'm sitting and waiting and participating in these debates and seeing that, you know, maybe in a couple of years we'll sort things out, and whoever wins will get to write the history books that will be used in classrooms all over the world, for example.
Now, in terms of business architecture, what are your top recommended business architecture best practices?
I would say start with a business architecture community of practice in your organization. And when I say community of practice, you don't have to have people who are actually doing business architecture today to be part of that community. You can have, you know, product managers, business analysts, technology managers, enterprise architects, project managers even, be part of that community. And use that community as a jump-off point or as a way to enhance the knowledge of people on what business architecture is all about. And, you know, maybe you will pick a few passionate people there who will say, hey, you know, this is something I really want to do for the rest of my life, for example. And then you can start identifying people who want to pursue that track more seriously. And perhaps that's when the next step comes in. Once you have that community of practice, then one best practice I have in the organization, setting up, for example, a business architecture unit, is to start aligning with a senior executive, business executive, and say, you know, I'm a so-and-so, like whether, you know, fill in the blanks, I'm a project manager, business architect, business analyst, process analyst, enterprise architect, and I'm here to help you operationalize your ideas. Is there a way we can work together? So that's the next step. You start working closely with a business executive. And, you know, they are more than happy to have another hand in helping them solve their business problems, whether it's in the areas of customer satisfaction, low sales revenues, or even just not meeting launch deadlines, for example. And lastly, probably, and I know there are more, but in the interest of time, I can only speak of three. The third one is, you know, grab a business book. When was the last time you've ever sat down, downloaded an ebook from Amazon in your Kindle, or bought something from a bookstore that's related to business? And I'm specifically targeting IT folks. And, you know, you might realize that, hey, you're missing at 80% of the world by just sticking to technology books, for example. So grab a business book and read it from cover to cover.
What are your top challenges then in your current role as a working business architect?
Let me think about that. I know that patience is a virtue, and I'm normally an impatient person. And that's the challenge there, because I feel a kind of restlessness that, for example, Wells Fargo, a 270,000 member, you know, organization, we move slowly like an aircraft carrier. So if I, you know, propose something like, and which I've done and I'm continually doing, a prioritization scheme for projects and ideas using a business capability model, I know it will take years before the organization buys into that concept. But once they adopt that point of view and they say, okay, thanks business architecture for your contribution, we will use this going forward as a way to manage our project portfolio. For me, that's already a big win, and that's a challenge, but at the same time, I know that if I'm able to vet these ideas against the best and the brightest in the organization, I know that we have made a significant contribution, that we are not just a flash in the pan. So that's a major challenge I have right now in my current work. The other challenge I have is, what if, just what if, you know, we come out with that business architecture body of knowledge handbook, and there is a deluge of demand from folks to say, hey, I want that. That's what I want to do for the rest of my life. How do we, you know, handle that kind of, well, that's a good thing, right? But again, there's a question of demand and mentorship and being able to lead people in the right direction. And that's where there's a leadership crisis I would foresee happening pretty soon, with not just with the society, but even with the guild, in terms of trying to lead a way for an army of, you know, would-be business architects saying that, yes, that is exactly what I want to do. So those are just a couple of challenges.
In the sort of organizational hierarchy, who do you report to?
I report to, you might say, I would say I'm four levels below the president of community banking. So I report to the business, not IT.
Now, how will you measure success?
Success for us is not measured in terms of dollar revenues or how much we've contributed to the bottom line. And the reason being is that, and this might be different for other organizations, our business architecture team here is a base resource. In other words, we don't bill our time against projects. We serve a staff function similar to, let's say, a CFO would serve as a staff function to the CEO. We provide advisory services to product managers and lines of business managers, whether it's in the area of mergers and acquisition, new product launches, process improvements, and so on. However, that doesn't excuse us from being able to come up with hard metrics. For example, we are trying to measure in terms of hours saved due to missed requirements and rework during the development phase and how we have contributed to those metrics because we came early into the picture in terms of capturing their business requirements using, let's say, a business use case model or a business capability model. And I would say, you know, the response has been pretty positive, and the most of the stakeholders that we relate with have, based on the surveys that we've always given them and asked them to complete after every engagement, it's always been positive, saying that, you know, we couldn't have done this better without the assistance of the business architecture team. But again, how do we measure success? We are still far from having real dollar and hard number figures, but that's not to say that we will not arrive at that, you know, anytime soon.
You know, do you tie into things like ITIL, COBIT, or the IVI Capability Maturity Framework out of Ireland?
We don't really measure ourselves in that sense, just like the CMMI maturity or ITIL maturity model. However, we have our own version of a business architecture maturity model. Similar in concept, you know, where you start off with ad hoc processes all the way up to the most mature level, wherein you have pretty much self-organizing teams being able to govern themselves and being able to be agile and flexible at the same time to respond to changes. Again, we're waiting for that wonderful artifact called the Business Architecture Body of Knowledge Handbook to come out of the press, and using that as a baseline or foundation, then we will be able to assess organizations' capability and maturity in terms of adopting many or all of the knowledge areas within that body of knowledge.
Are you talking to other organizations like ISACA or other organizations with different kinds of frameworks?
Well, right now, not actively, but my hope and prayer is that with FIPO, FIPO really is like the United Nations of IT, I would say. And you have participated in some of our sessions, Steve, and you've seen that pretty much it is a very collaborative, consensus-based organization. And any input from any member is highly valued, because definitely when we sit down on the table, we are, you might say, first among equals, and we all have our own expertise. And I always keep my eyes and ears open for any way I can collaborate with your organization, for example, or you know, the other enterprise architecture related organizations with the IEEE and you know, and so on and so forth. So yes, maybe not as much as we wanted today, but definitely it's in our roadmap.
You're a working business architect, and you have interest in all the different aspects of business architecture. What are the resources that you use and that the audience can use to help them in their work?
The toolbox or the toolkit that we use is an accumulation of several, you know, toolkits from other professions. One of the key professions that I found very helpful when I do my work is the business analysis toolkit or toolbox. If you dig deeper into the business analysis body of knowledge handbook, for example, the version 2, you will see there a section called the techniques section. And they've listed probably about 50 to 80 techniques on how to, for example, elicit requirements. And we, and I particularly, use that as a resource. And whenever I'm confronted, for example, with a problem that's expressed by a client within the organization, I always ask myself, okay, what can I use to, what artifact or deliverable or technique can I use that will match the style of my client? And the end goal is to help this client define their business requirements. So I can go ahead and use a business use case model, or the Baba calls it the business scenario modeling. I can also use a context diagram modeling, for example, or I can use any of the other types of requirements elicitation techniques, like the Ishikawa diagram or the fishbone diagram, for example. Right now, I am, in an engagement wherein, before I even dive into eliciting requirements, I need to identify the key stakeholders that I will invite to those workshops. So I'm using the stakeholder analysis technique that is in that business analysis body of knowledge, using, and I'm not sure if you're familiar with this, the onion diagram, where you have in the middle are the key SMEs or subject matter experts, and then outside of that would be the influencers, and then you go further out, you will have those line of business executives who might have not much influence in the current scope of your engagement, but are highly important, and therefore they need to be kept in the loop, for example. So that's just an example of some tools and techniques that I use. And of course, let's not forget that if you're a business architect, you're also pretty much managing your own engagement. So the whole project management, knowledge area, life cycle comes into play. And fortunately, I have that background because I'm also a project management professional certified, and therefore I can manage and track my time against, the budget, and be able to deliver on time, on quality, at the right cost for the internal client.
Do you have any specific web resources that the audience can go to?
I would say if you are looking for just a general overview of business architecture, what we've done in the Business Architecture Society is that we've put together a resources page in our website. So you can go to basociety.com. So that's basociety.com. And you can click on the resources tab. What you will see there are different sections based on where you are in your journey in business architecture. So there's a general section of what is business architecture, what are the skills needed to become a business architect. We've talked about artifacts, methods, and deliverables, and so on and so forth. That's a good start. And then, of course, you can go to other sites that will talk about business architecture. The Open Group, for example, has their own section on business architecture. The Object Management Group, or OMG, they have a special interest group that mainly deals with business architecture and setting or creating standards for business architecture. You can all, Google this, and you will be able to link to their sites. And if you have the, if you're fortunate enough to have a subscription, let's say, to Forrester, they have a ton of material there on business architecture, as well as Kotter Consortium and Gartner, of course.
And what are the top five disruptive technologies, and how will they have impact?
You've mentioned one of them, which is the consumerization of IT. And that trend will continue, I would say, for the next decade. And really just because of the law that more and more of processing power will double in so many years at probably half the cost, for example. I'm just extrapolating here. And because of that, either things will get smaller in terms of form factor and therefore more mobile, and because of the network effect, more people will demand it, and therefore supply will be more and prices will go down pretty much. That's how I look at the business driver for this consumerization of IT. And take a look at ourselves. For example, I've been telling my IT department I can very well afford my own cell phone or smartphone and laptop because it's cheaper now. Therefore, I don't need to rely on the IT department to have to procure those for me. But then, of course, because of security reasons, they don't allow us to do that. But that just tells you that consumerization of IT in terms of mobile technologies, for example, will continue to be with us for a long period of time. The other one, I know there are five items that you're asking for, but let's see how far we can go here. The second one is the XaaS phenomenon. And X there really is a wild card, you might say, for anything that's either application, platform, software. And AAS means as a service. So platform as a service, software as a service, infrastructure as a service. And the more common term for that really is cloud computing. The concept has been around for many decades. In fact, when I was with IBM Global Services as the country services manager for IBM Global Services, I was the one who was pushing actively for e-business hosting, for example, since anyway IBM owned the large mainframes and the supercomputers. You know, I'm sure we can spare some capacity out of these data centers that we have in IBM, for example, to our clients so that they don't need to do it themselves and manage it themselves. And of course, you know, the folks at IBM were aghast and shocked. How can we sell more hardware now? And I said, no, in the long run, you know, once these customers buy into your processing power, it will be harder for them to leave, and they'll be your customers for life. And that was, year 2099? When e-business was invented by IBM. Now, fast forward 12, 13 years later, that's exactly what's happening. All the major hardware vendors, all the major software vendors like Microsoft, Oracle, even, you know, pure play software providers like Salesforce.com have bought into that idea that customers will be with you for life, of course, as long as you stick to your service level agreements, will be there for life. And you don't need to worry about selling software and hardware anymore because you make money out of the transactions, out of the consulting services that you provide them on the site, for example. So that's the point of view from the point of view of vendors. But from the point of view, let's say, of a consumer, customer, of a bank customer, the same thing. Consumerization of IT will have a huge impact on how I deal with my bank, for example. I don't need to be in front of a PC to transfer money to my son who needs his allowance for the week. I can do so comfortably while waiting at the cash register at my local Safeway organization to transfer funds. And that will extend all the way even more to trading, and we're seeing that already, and so on and so forth. So those are just a couple, Steve, of key trends that I'm seeing. And maybe I'll stop here, and maybe if you have more questions, I can answer them.
You know, those are good insights into what's sort of having an impact worldwide. Now, what specific challenges and opportunities should IT practitioners and businesses embrace today and into the future?
Well, first of all, we are still in a recessionary environment here in North America. And I guess I couldn't speak for the whole world, but you have to have a different tactic when you're in a recession versus when you're in a boom stage. The one that we've seen in 5 or even 8 years ago, for example. The tactic there is that we need to reskill, retool, because now is the time to prepare when the wave is, the wave for change is coming, for the boom cycle is coming. We have to be ready so that we can ride that wave. And if not, then sad to say, we will be left behind again as IT practitioners, specifically, it's education. If you can, for example, go on a graduate study, for example, or finish your bachelor's, but more focus on the business, because we know that because of the consumerization of IT, more and more of the tasks that we do today, whether I'm a network engineer or a programmer, developer, is slowly being outsourced to these major cloud providers, for example. Even architecture, enterprise architecture, the way we know it right now, of trying to govern network infrastructures, application, and hardware infrastructure, all of those are going to be outsourced the minute your organization outsources to a cloud. So what's left, therefore, for an enterprise architect to do, right? And that's why the being closer to the business, helping them vet their ideas while it's still in the conceptualization or discovery phase, will define the new enterprise architect, which we in business architecture call business architect. And therefore, retooling yourself, reskilling on the language of business, getting an MBA, for example, used to be a nice to have for folks, and say, I don't need an MBA to, earn six digits in my role as an IT engineer. Well, unfortunately, that's not the case anymore. Again, because we are in a recessionary environment. So getting an MBA might be a good investment. And I myself, getting a DBA, which is the higher level of an MBA, has helped me a lot in terms of not just conversing with business folks, but gaining credibility among the IT folks, because now they see me as the real business person within IT, which is funny because nothing really happened except that I just read a few more business books than they've done, for example. So that's the outlook that I would foresee, and it's a slow recovery, I would say, and as President Obama would say, it'll only get worse before it gets better. So hang in there.
Now, you're talking about a DBA. What is the cost of a DBA?
Well, in my case, I am quite lucky because I got a scholarship from the school, and so that helps me pay off some of that, and my work pays as permitted by, up to the amount that's permitted by law in terms of a tax shield. And then the rest of it is student loans, which the cost really is not much different from an MBA, what it costs for an MBA, except that, for example, instead of a course being 3 units, it's 4 units for a doctoral program. So I couldn't give you a figure right now, Steve, but it shouldn't be any different from an MBA cost.
So why wouldn't people just go directly to a DBA rather than an MBA?
They could. Yeah, they could. If you have access to a school, and DBA is really a new phenomenon. You can't, for example, go to UC Berkeley and say, hey, I'd like to enroll in your DBA program, because they will say, well, we don't have one. We have a PhD in business administration, and we require you to be a student full-time with us for the next couple of years, which, again, you have to compute your opportunity loss, which I did, and I said, forget it. So I shopped around. There's one in Stanford. There's one in Harvard. They offer DBA programs, mainly geared towards the working professional, and most of the classes are held weeknights and weekends, for example. So you have to look around for the right school. I don't think there's one offered online yet, but I wouldn't be surprised if there's one going to be offered soon.
What innovation should we be watching for in the future?
Well, I'm a hobbyist in terms of the web. In other words, I write iPhone apps. I create HTML5 websites. I create blogs and so on and so forth. User-generated content is, I think, a key innovation that we will see more and more in the future. You've seen this user-generated content in social media, for example. But I think the real impact will be felt when there's a tipping point wherein people start contributing quality work for free. And what's in it for them? It's just a source of pride, a source of enjoyment, or even some kind of giving back to society. And I myself, I volunteered in several organizations to help them simply with running their websites. So these are nonprofits. Or, I take photographs of events and giving it out royalty free. But these are high quality photos that normally folks will charge an arm and a leg for these. you will see more of myself probably in the future, when people will start to generate content, not in a sloppy way, you know, in a disorganized way, but will offer content, whether it's to write a journal article for free to enhance knowledge, or contribute a nice photograph that's royalty free that can be used by different media outlets, and so on and so forth, or even writing a chapter of a novel for free, and just the fact that your name is there as part of the authors. That innovation will continue, and I call that UGC innovation, user-generated content innovation happening, and we will see more of that in the future.
You know, what are some areas of controversy in the areas that you work?
Well, just like in any kind of paradigm shift, there will be winners and losers. Especially in business architecture, there's a growing debate on what really is business architecture and what is in scope and out of scope. How different are we, for example, from process analysts, from business analysts, from, you know, enterprise architects, and so on and so forth. The main conflict or controversy there is that, unfortunately, there can only be one definition of business architecture that will emerge as a winner. We can't have many definitions, for example. And because of that, along the way, you know, ideas that do not gain popular support will fall by the wayside. And as I've mentioned, history books will be written by the victors. And when we come out with a business architecture body of knowledge handbook, for example, that is one book that's written by victors. So if you want to be part of that, you know, winning party, join in the conversation today. You know, put in your 2 cents worth. Do not be afraid, because this might be the only opportunity where you can actually define the future of a profession such as business architecture. And win or lose, at least you have offered, and this is, I guess, where the melding of user-generated content comes in. You've offered your user-generated content to benefit mankind. And that's what's most important, because at the end of the day, you know, we will go and come and go here in the world, but our collective knowledge, whatever knowledge we've put together in a repository, will live for a long, long time.
I have an interview series with Nick Malik where he talks about enterprise architecture. Do you agree with all of his views on enterprise architecture?
I would say he has a very good viewpoint on and opinion on a lot of aspects of enterprise architecture, including business architecture. In fact, I have used some of his work when he got involved in the Microsoft offering called Motion to help define what business capability maps are. But I guess we diverge as well on some areas, which, as I mentioned, we are still in the process of vetting it against our membership in the society, and maybe at FIPO when we start writing that white paper on enterprise architecture.
Are you able to describe the areas where you diverge?
Well, I don't think in the interest of time we have that luxury right now. I would need probably another full hour with you, Steve, to discuss it. But yes, if there's a forum where I can actually sit down with Nick and discuss these ideas, I will be glad to accept it.
Now, what is the value in professional associations for computing professionals?
It's really the ability to shake hands with fellow enthusiasts, and especially in a world wherein we've gone virtual and multitasking. The value of having a face-to-face encounter with someone who is as passionate as you are in your area of interest is invaluable. And that's why professional organizations, we, especially in the Business Architecture Society, we're chapter-based, we highly recommend having face-to-face meeting at least once a quarter in a year to be able to enhance this experience.
Andrew, do you have any additional predictions of future business IT trends, or do you think you've covered it in your answers to the innovation question or the disruptive technology question?
Yeah, I let's leave it at that right now, because otherwise, your guess is as good as mine. But those are the areas of innovation and disruptive technologies where I'm passionate about. And yes, I would stick to those.
You know, we look at other professions like medicine, law, engineering, accounting, and there's this sort of quality assurance process. And there's a process for managing risk by credentialing professionals. And in addition to that, they are all recognized professions with demonstrated professional development, adherence to code, code of ethics, recognized credentialing of some sort, some kind of penalties or you know, ways of ensuring that people sort of stick to the, you know, the framework within those professions. What are your thoughts on computing as a recognized profession? So there's some assurance of quality, there's some kind of risk mitigation by being credentialed, people acting in the public good and in their clients' best interests and so on, you know, demonstrate professional development, adherence to code of ethics and so on. What are your viewpoints on that?
I am a big, big proponent of credentials and certification and compliance with code of standards and ethics. I myself being a credentialed practitioner for project management business analysis, and I'm in the process of getting my master architect certification with the Open Group. I strongly believe that for us to succeed as a society, we need to be accountable to one another. And just as you rightly mentioned, professions such as medicine, in medicine and accounting, they've been highly successful because of that. They're able to police their own ranks. They are able to self-govern. They're able to self-regulate themselves. And you know, that's why more and more people are attracted, because of the high level of quality. And that's pretty much my aspiration for, let's say, a field that's as nascent as business architecture, and to see that grow eventually to become a household term, that even your grandmother or your 8-year-old niece should be able to define what business architecture is, and mainly because it has gotten credibility along the years based on specific achievements of certain credentialed individuals.
Now, I've got a fairly sort of segmented question here. It's a five-parter. And that is, I want you to share your deep insights on each of the following parts. And this is your candid thoughts on emerging technologies, that is the CIO position versus the CTO. And the five parts are, the first one being technology to grow revenue versus technology to increase efficiencies. Again, your thoughts on the CIO positions for the CTO position on the impact of business driving the technology decision. The next is on technology perspectives from the customer's point of view. The fourth part of this multi-part question is, are CIOs becoming the chief innovation officer? And the last or fifth part is, what are other hot topics? And again, this is about CIOs versus CTOs.
All right. Would you want me to answer first part?
Yes, that's right. Technology to grow revenue versus technology to increase efficiency.
Yeah. Technology by itself is only a tool. And I always like this to say this to folks when I'm in front of technologists, is that a fool with a tool is still a fool. And whether it's a business person wielding technology or a technology person wielding technology for whatever purpose it may serve, unless that person, whether it's a CIO or whether it's a CTO or a business person or a CIO, has to be very clear in his or her mind, really, what is the business problem that we're trying to solve here? And technology might be the answer, but it may also not be the answer. And by the way, when we refer to technology here, let me just clarify, we're talking about information technology. But from a operations management point of view, really, technology doesn't necessarily have to involve information. It could be the way they define technology is a body of knowledge of best practices. So it could be technology to create a better widget, right, in a manufacturing industry, for example, not having to do with IT. So technology to increase revenues, technology for efficiency, I think that's the right way to frame the question, that technology really can do both, and it is only a tool to achieve both. But at the end of the day, if technology is not the right answer, then we should be willing to part with that tool and use another tactic to increase revenue or to increase effectiveness and efficiency.
Now, part two of this question of the CIO versus CTO is the impact of business driving the technology decision.
The point of view of a CIO is, yes, in terms of lip service, business should drive technology because we're order takers, right? As a CIO, I'm here. As long as they approve my budget, I'm willing to do whatever they want me to do, whether it's to roll out a voice over
IP network across the different distribution, across my branches, for example, or to outsource part of my software development team outside of North America, for example. From a CTO perspective, I think they want to get away from being an order taker to be part of the decision-making table. So they actually get invited to senior management meetings and even to board meetings. And that's a nice aspiration because you not only take orders, but you actually help in defining what those orders will be. And when you sit in front of the CEO, the types of questions that are being asked there, and when you sit with the CFO as well, with a legal counsel, and with the human resource person, the topics suddenly shift. That may be new for an IT person, and such mundane topics as, you know, how come, you know, the competition is having more sales per this quarter compared to ours. As a CIO, sometimes you never think of those, but as a CTO, you actually at the back of your mind say, oh, okay, if that's a problem, maybe technology can help, right? Maybe process improvement can help, or maybe kind of a combination of both can help. Now, the third question, can you refresh my memory, please, Steve?
Yeah, that is with regards to your candid thoughts on emerging technologies, CIO versus CTO. And the third part is the technology perspectives from the customer's point of view.
Yeah, let me start with the customer. The customer has a, for example, with a bank, the customer has a very specific purpose why they have a relationship with the bank, and especially when we talk about online and mobile channels, when they access their accounts, for example. They want to check their balances, how much money they have while they're on the run, you know, so to speak, so that either they can buy something or they can transfer money to somebody or pay their bills. So they want to use a channel in a very utilitarian way. In other words, don't get in my way, Wells Fargo. Don't present me with all this advertisement and I have to do four clicks or four swipes in my tablet to get to where I want to be. I just want maybe one or two swipes or clicks to transfer money, for example. And I think that's the innovation that we want to see happening, and I'd like to see happening, for example, in the bank, that we should always put the customer interest first rather than the bank's interest. That really we shouldn't get away of whatever the customer is doing or plans to do. So if that means they want two clicks to get their money, we've done that with ATM. What we've set up with Wells Fargo ATMs is that if you look at your screen, for example, on the left-hand side, you will see a favorites section. So that when you are asked for your PIN, for example, you can actually immediately say, oh, the last transaction was I withdrew $100. Just tap on that button and you're done. You get out. And that was very quick. Whereas maybe a year ago, you had to go through three taps on the screen, for example. So being customer focused should be the main criterion for any kind of new initiative or innovation, either from a CIO or CTO point of view.
This fourth part of the question is the role of the CIO being changed to be chief innovation officer?
That's a nice aspiration, but I don't think that will happen automatically. The being an innovative person, and you know, me, for example, I'm one of my strengths when I took the Strengths Finder survey, one of my strengths out of five is ideation. I'm very good at thinking of ways to connect the dots and being able to look at a chaotic environment and say, I think I see a pattern here. So that's one behavior of a person who constantly comes up with new ideas. You can't train a person to do that just by labeling them as innovative. I don't know how I got it. I know that as early as fourth grade, I was already participating in science fairs and coming up with some weird gadgets and gizmos that I invented. And nobody taught me how to do that. So being innovative is innate. It has to be a strength of the person, and it should be a way of life. And in a sense, when I say strength, it's almost equivalent to second nature. In other words, I don't have to remind myself, hey, Andrew, be innovative or be, hey, generate ideas. It's almost second nature for me to do that. Whereas some other folks, they have to take that extra step of reminding themselves, okay, time to be innovative or time to generate ideas. So a CIO who wants to transform themselves to be a chief innovation officer has to have that innate talent for ideation to be branded as innovative. And of course, the titles you can play around with it, but at the end of the day, in terms of results, a truly innovative person, whether or not he or she has a title of chief innovation officer, will generate amazing ideas.
Now, do you see other hot topics or areas of controversy involving CIOs versus CTOs?
I've seen some organizations do away with those titles and they just call them business technology officers or chief business technology officers. That's what they term them. And maybe it's more of a marketing ploy to satisfy, for example, your shareholders and to boost your stock, saying that, hey, you know, I'm in line with what's in fashion or what's the fad today. But I think that one controversy that will not easily go away, that people are going to start rebranding their C-level executives' titles to align with what's the fad out there. But again, as I mentioned, it's really the results that will matter most for shareholders. If based on that rebranding or reorganization, your top line and bottom line have, you've contributed to both the top line and bottom line aspects of your financial statements, then you will be gratefully rewarded by your shareholders.
Now we're now near to the end of our interview. We just had last few questions here. This one still is a fairly complicated one in the sense it's multi-part. This one involves the board point of view, and I want to get your insights into the board's point of view. And your insights would be in five areas. Part one would be the board's top concerns as it relates to the integration of technology and business. Part two is who do board members rely on within the organization. Part three is deploying an IT governance program. Part four is innovation and its impact on the organization's future success. And part five is preparing the workforce for the future. So I'd like to get your insights then first on part one, what you think boards are thinking about their top concerns as it relates to the integration of technology and business.
I've sat in several boards in the past, and today I still am part of a couple of nonprofit boards. And the dynamics in a board is different from a management board, in a management meeting. We're in politics. Plays a big part in board meetings. And again, being savvy at politics is something farthest from the mind of an IT person, but that's part of the retooling, reskilling aspect I was talking about earlier, that you have to learn how to play politics. And politics mainly is being able to get things done through other folks and make them feel good about it, right? And that's, you normally equate that with leadership. And that's really what it's all about. Board members are leaders in their industries, in their fields, and that's why they are part of the board. And what they want to do, aside from the altruistic, altruistic sense that they want to contribute to the benefit of their shareholders, because that's topmost in their minds, they also want to further their own personal agenda and interest. So when it comes to integration of IT and business, each board member will have their own interests in mind. And therefore, as a, for example, if I'm a CTO or a CIO or even a CEO, I have to take that into consideration. What will be a win? What will be a win for this board member if I did this and that? And integration of IT and business has several aspects. You can look at it from an operational point of view in terms of efficiencies. The big win there is cost saves. Or you can talk about it from the sales and marketing point of view, which the big win there for a board member is, increasing in market share or sales revenues. And again, at the end of the day, both are key performance indicators of success in an organization that's been able to put their business and IT integration act together. So I would reply to that as saying that you should always come up with your own stakeholder analysis when it comes to taking the interests of board members in business IT integration.
So Andrew, what are your viewpoints then on who the board members rely on within the organization?
I would say that in general, and it might be different for, several organizations. In general, board members have vested interests that they want to protect. And one of those, are the organizations that they represent in that board, whether they are captains of their own industry or they represent a specific customer segment. And most, because they represent the interests of their industry or customer segment, they are almost always risk averse, and they rely on the legal team first and foremost to keep them on track. And that's why board members have been on compliance and risk mitigation, risk management, so that whatever decisions they make, either as an individual or as a collegial body, they have to be well aware of the consequences of their votes or actions. So that's the primary role that they rely on the legal and compliance folks. And then secondly, they rely on the finance folks to keep them on track and honest. So they rely on timely, accurate, and accessible information to make timely decisions. So those are just a couple of roles that they rely on.
I'm just thinking that, of course, they look at the operational sides of the C-level executives, or represented by the president itself in terms of driving strategy.
Yeah, the reason I didn't mention that, because that's almost always gets mentioned, right? But really what gets overlooked is that board members are risk averse, and the people who can help them be honest and on track and, CYA are the legal folks and the finance folks.
So what are boards thinking about in terms of deploying an IT governance program, or do they think about that?
With regulatory pressures, yes, especially for an industry such as the bank, IT audits are increasingly becoming part of, the daily routine. And we have a regulatory agency that has come up with guidelines, for example, FIAC, that governs such things as what gets displayed on a website, how do we communicate electronically with our customers, and so on. And the board, as part of the risk management plan, has to comply with all of these regulatory and legal mandates by agencies.
How about the board's concerns and involvement in innovation and its impact on the organization's future success?
I believe there's a lot of room for them to define the future, the business. And however, to work out the how part of how to operationalize these strategies, they are better left with the operations team, with the chief executive and the chief operating officer of the organization. But definitely in terms of setting the vision and mission of the organization, that's really one of the reasons why they're there, and because of their collective expertise, they're able to steer the company in the right direction amidst the distressing signals that they receive on a daily basis, either from competition, from customers, business partners, and the macroeconomic factors as a whole.
However, you think that boards, though, should make that somewhat of a priority in some of their discussions and leveraging that work through the operational side, through the CEO and so on?
Unfortunately, they don't have much leeway to do that. Again, I'm speaking from experience as having been a board member for a couple of corporations and now for a couple of nonprofits. The board's role really is to be a mentor to the senior executive team, to guide them to, set the direction. But in terms of the implementation aspect, I believe there has to be that separation. They have to give the operational team a lot of freedom and leeway in terms of operationalizing their ideas. That is not to say, though, that offline they cannot converse with the senior managers and talk to them about specific ideas they have on how to operationalize those ideas. But generally in a plenary session or in a board meeting where minutes are strictly taken, a board member cannot go out of the limb and direct or mandate a specific action, again, at the risk of interfering with the operations of the corporation.
Or perhaps they can ask those kinds of questions, making the CEO accountable at board meetings, indicating, you know, what percentage of their budget is going towards innovation.
Right. That could be, you know, part of the, you might say, balanced scorecard that the board is tracking, yes.
And in terms of boards, what are they thinking about preparing the workforce for the future?
Are you talking about the employees of the organization?
Yes, that's correct.
Yes. They definitely, again, can mentor the operations team on where they think the employees of the organization, whether these are managers or people who are contributors, to where they believe they can be utilized or most contribute value to. And they can outline the path, the general direction of where the skills are most needed for the organization. Now, in terms, again, of implementing that, it will be up to the C-level executives to execute those, you know, make those vision a reality. And if, for example, the board feels that they're lagging behind competition in terms of the aspect of social media in you know, integrating social media in their offerings or in their operations, pretty much the operations team will take that at heart and then come up with their own, you know, short-term, medium-term, and long-term plan on how to operationalize that.
So I guess what you're saying, though, is that the board can have some impact in terms of the scorecard being used to measure the performance of the C-level executives, and they can ask questions that can drive some strategic thinking and make the C-level executives accountable in the questions that they're asking in these areas.
Right. You're exactly right there. In terms of, again, the role of the board, it's really to be a check and balance for the operations team. But there has to be that distinct line drawn that they, by mandate, should not demand or dictate the how part or how to implement or operationalize ideas, because that is left best to the management team.
And I guess that's an area of controversy, too, though, when you see different major stakeholders and shareholders get a seat on the board or try to drive who's going to be on the board.
Now that's why you have a position called chairman/CEO. Boy, that's a very powerful position. I hold that position right now in one of the nonprofits, and I pretty much can shut down the whole company if I want to. But I guess that's not the best practice. You normally have the chairman separate from a CEO, for example.
Now, from your extensive speaking travels and work, do you have any interesting stories to share?
Well, most of the candid experiences I've had has always been, you know, people approaching me and asking, you know, well, what do I really do for a living? Right, because I get involved with so many nonprofits and foundations that do I really have a day job? And I said, yeah, I do. I work for a real company like Wells Fargo. But I guess that's the other part of me. I love to give back to society whatever I learn. And I know that, and for sure, I mean, I will not stick forever with one company. Eventually, I'll move on. And I know that in the long term, my future goal is to be able to help my, you know, fellow countrymen improve their lives, because I grew up in a third world country in the Philippines. And I know that with all the knowledge I have learned being here in the U.S., I know that I can contribute back to my country in terms of alleviating poverty and corruption in that. And that's why my dissertation topic has always been the use of electronic governance in helping eliminate poverty and corruption in third world countries. So that's, you know, one anecdote I can give you about people asking what I really do for a day job.
Now, we've covered a lot of territory in this interview, and I'm going to switch the tables now. If you were doing this interview, what questions would you ask, and then what would be your answers?
Well, I would say, for example, Steve, you know, you do this pretty much for a living, but what do you really enjoy most doing and don't mind not getting paid for it? So in my case, for example, I'm a big fan of endurance sports, triathlon, ultra marathons. I would love to do that daily if I can. And, you know, and that's why I formed a company called Enduroman Corporation. And the concept behind that is what I learn in the field, you know, training, I definitely can translate it back into the boardroom. And our goal for the corporation is to train corporate athletes. And whether it's in the area of trying to win over competition, trying to strategize on you know, having a race strategy, being able to overcome defeat and failure and bounce back to win and become victorious. Those are some of the basic principles that corporate executives can learn from athletes, for example.
Andrew, we've been on a remarkable journey, and we've also gained some deep insights from all of the great experiences you've had and are continuing to have, and the impact you're having on the world on a global basis. And we thank you for coming in today and sharing your wisdom with our audience.
My pleasure, Steve. Thank you. And, you know, if you have further questions, feel free to send it my way.
I'm Steve Ibaraki, and this concludes our exclusive interview with Andrew Guittarde, business architect, Wells Fargo, founding chairman, Business Architecture Society.